the new covenants. Thought it was important to look at the new covenant, since when we came to the new covenant in our study of the word, it says in the AV, it says the word from the Lord, the word from Jehovah was to the various prophets. And we were studying that through Jeremiah. As we came to Jeremiah 31, beginning in verse 31, we picked up there looking at the promises that God will give to Israel in the future with his new covenant to Israel. And when we looked at that, that was a diversion. We went off after the new covenant. But I still believe it is an important thing to understand. It's an important thing to understand when it comes to the concepts of biblical interpretation and hermeneutics. When we consider it, if we are careful, we will see that you do need to be consistent. You do need to take things literally in context, and you do need to be contextual, and you do need to be careful with it. And so that was that's where we've been. But it does demonstrate something, that God did promise something for Israel. He does have some better things that he's promised to us. And so God does have promises in his book to two peoples. And so what we've been looking at has not really dealt with the church. And I'm just going to say a couple of things dealing with some of the premises that we came with in looking at the new covenant. We come with some premises. Premises that when it's spoken to a particular group of people and it's addressed for a particular time, a specific time, specific people with specific promises, it relates to specifics, to specific people. And when God cuts a covenant, we will go with a biblical premise in Galatians chapter 3 and verse 15. When God makes a covenant, he doesn't change it. He doesn't annul it. He doesn't take away from it, nor does he add to it. And so that's something. If a man doesn't change a covenant, God doesn't either. God never changes a covenant. And so the covenant that he's going to cut with Israel and with the house of Judah, that is something out in the future. And so he's not applying it to the church before it gets in it, and including the church within that. Another thing that premise we've come with is that not only does God not change a covenant when he cuts a covenant with a people or makes a covenant in the New Testament, when he covenants with a people, he not only doesn't change it, but he also will fulfill it just as he promises. And when we looked at it, we see that God is not dealing with Jew and Gentile alone anymore, and that's something we're aware of. But 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 32, we have noted and emphasized that God sees three different races today. And so you have Jew, Gentile, Church of God. And so when we look at the Church of God and the Jew are not the same. The Church of God and the Gentile are not the same. The church is, though, and the thing that was something that was unknown in the Old Testament was that in some way, Jew and Gentile were going to be one entity, one race. They were going to be something new. And so a new man was created in Christ Jesus. Christ created in himself, out from Jew and Gentile, out from the two, one new man, so making peace. And we've looked at some of those things. And so God is not, he's dealing now with the church, and the church does not receive the promises to Israel. And Israel is, the only way that a Jew can become part of the church is by the same way a Gentile does. And it's by believing the gospel, by grace through faith. And it's a God-given thing that by which any of us have believed the gospel and then come to a place where we have been born again, so that as a result of the new covenant, we do have life, and that life is eternal. And that life is because Christ is written in our hearts. He's written in our hearts by the Holy Spirit. And so that's kind of where we've come with the premise, though, that God makes a promise to a particular group of people with a covenant. He doesn't change it, and he doesn't add to it. And he does, so he doesn't say, well, I'm going to add the Gentiles to this, or I'm going to add the church to this. He doesn't add to it, nor does he take away. And so when we've gone through the passages with New Covenant and the New Testament, we've noted that the context is following the day of Pentecost with the coming of the Holy Spirit, and the Holy Spirit had a lot to do with the changes that began, and he had all to do with the changes that took place on the day of Pentecost with relationship to the beginnings of the church. And the New Covenant was by Christ's blood, the one with the church, not with the Israel. It's not the same. And so I didn't intend to go back and review all of that. We've done spent a lot of time dealing with that. But when we've looked at these things, we do look at when we looked at the covenants and we looked at the two new covenants, we didn't look at the similarities, we looked at the differences. And so you do have to look at the differences. If you don't look at the differences, you will end up in a theological ditch, ultimately, because if you look at similarity, similarity is not identity. And when you look at the new covenants, about the closest thing that comes to similarity is that God is the one who makes both covenants. God makes the covenants, but it is something that God makes with two different people. And so God does that, but the only thing other than that is they're both referred to as new. And we've argued about new. Because something, if you have something that's new, does it mean it's all the same? Every time you find the word new, we find a new man. Well, is the new man the same as the old man? No. Is something new, or if you have two new things, are they the same? No. If you have two different things that are different, they're not the same just because they are referred to as something new. And so we've gone through that and spent time. So that's where we're going to leave that off. And I am going to go back to Jeremiah 31, and we're going to just kind of pick up there for a little bit. I'm not sure exactly how far I want to go with this, how far we should go with it, but we're going to come back where we left off in going looking at the word of Jehovah was to. It was to the prophet Jeremiah, or the word that was spoken to Jeremiah, but it was something, it was Jehovah who speaks, and we have pointed that out. And just to get our minds back into it again, we will pick up there again, but I do want to go back and just build a little bit more background. It's been a while since we've been here. And so when we look at Jeremiah, remember at the time frame here and what is going on, Jeremiah is a prophet with relationship to the southern kingdom. You started off with the kingdom, and we'll just begin with, Saul is the first king, but he was replaced. David was the one that was promised, tribe of Judah. He was the one who was promised to be king. And so you have David, Solomon. And so now Solomon had a son who was Rehoboam. Rehoboam was a rascal. He just wanted to increase taxes and beat the people up. So the people, the nation rebelled and the kingdom split. And so with the splitting under Rehoboam, you had the northern kingdom, which was known as Israel, southern kingdom, Judah. By the time you get down through many kings, you had kings that were good kings and bad kings on both sides, mostly bad, but there were a few good kings along the line. Now you get down to Isaiah, and in Isaiah's prophecy, we find the northern kingdom, Israel, being carried off by the Assyrians, and they're carried off into Assyria. And so they go into captivity. When we get to Jeremiah is dealing with the southern kingdom now. They're not in captivity yet, but Nebuchadnezzar has attempted to come. They've been saved for the day, a time or so. But when we come into where we are going to pick up today, we find that Nebuchadnezzar has surrounded the city now, and the southern kingdom is about to fall. And that's what he deals with in his prophecy. The southern kingdom is going to be taken away into captivity, just as the northern kingdom, they're going to be carried away into Babylon. And so the time is coming. They will go into captivity. And that's what we'll notice this morning. And so that is the picture in the background of Jeremiah. Now, before this, after this took place, we do see that God did divorce Israel, the whole nation. Israel had been his wife. He divorces them. They are no longer a people for him today. But yet we're going to see this morning that God is not through with Israel. He will bring them back in spite of what some theologians believe and teach. Israel will be restored to the land. And that's the picture we will see as once we get into chapter 32 this morning. But I just want to remind us today, where are the Jews today? Well, if they don't believe the gospel by faith, and if they're not saved, where are they? And to be saved, it takes a little bit of extra measure for them to be saved. The reason being, they are blinded today. Now, when we stop and look at the human race, the unsaved man, he is carnally, he's naturally, soulishly, we'll say, and it is the word soulish in 1 Corinthians 2:14, he is blinded. He's naturally or soulishly blinded. And so he's blinded so that he cannot receive the things from the Spirit of God because they're foolishness to him. And so he actively rejects them. He will not receive the things from the Spirit of God. He sees anything from the Spirit as being moronic to him. Neither does he have the ability to experientially know them because they do require spiritual discernment. He can't do it. And so the natural man, the soulish man, that's where he is, and that's where we all started out. And so he is blinded. Then you have the blindness to specific blindness to the gospel in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. But when you get over to 2 Corinthians chapter 4, there's satanic blindness. And Satan, he blinds the mind to the specific thing, to the gospel concerning Jesus Christ, by which men are saved. And so all men have that blindness. Satan will snatch the word away, the gospel away, concerning the gospel. He snatches it out of their heart. And so they can't believe without God the Holy Spirit ministering and stepping in and providing the faith to believe. Otherwise, no one would believe. But the Jew, he has another blindness, and that is because of their rejection. When the glory departed in Ezekiel, and we looked at it at Christmas time, and the glory returning as a babe, we had the arrival of God the Son and His joining His person to the human nature in Mary's womb, you have the God-man. Now the glory returned, and they rejected the glory when the glory did come back. And so as a result of their rejection of Christ, they do have another blindness that is added to it. Now, over in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, we do find there that they do have a blindness, and it's a judicial blindness. In 3:15, Paul says, even up to the day that he's writing, and it's true today too, that when they read their Old Testament, the book of Moses, when they read the Pentateuch, and when they read their Old Testament, they have a blinder to it. And really, their eyes are hardened to it. They really cannot understand it, and they don't. And so they can read their Old Testament and study it in synagogue. They don't get it. They have a blindness there. But over in Romans chapter 11, we've noticed this. And I'm just going to look at this and then move forward. But when we look at Romans chapter 11, I'm going to pick up a few verses here. He deals with the election of grace, illustrating election that comes from grace in verse 5. But in verse 6, if you need a definition of grace, you have it there. If it's of grace, it can't be works. If it's works, it can't be grace. And so grace and works don't get along together. But in verse 7, he says, we're going to just read a few verses beginning in verse 7. He says, what then? Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for, but the election that he's referred to back in verse 5 hath obtained it, and the rest were blinded. They were hardened or blinded. I kind of see this as if they have spiritual cataracts. It's a word for hardened, but they're hardened. They're blinded to the blinded with reference to the gospel. According as it is written, God hath given them the spirit of slumber, eyes that they should not see and ears that they should not hear unto this day. And so it was true up to that time that when Paul wrote this, and it's still true, they cannot understand. I'm just going down to verse 10, and it says, let their eyes be darkened that they may not see, and bow down their back always. And so it just anticipates that and tells us where that the Jews, they do have a judicial blindness under judgment. They're blinded when it comes to the gospel and what they need for salvation by Satan, but they have another blind to it, and that is the judicial blindness because of their rejection of Christ as overall as a nation. Now, a few Jews are going to be saved and left in the place of blessing, the olive tree and the stock of blessing, but most of them are going to be removed. But down in verse 17, the Gentiles are grafted in. But God is going to, he's hardened them, blinded them, so that he's going to now turn and save some Gentiles until the fullness of the Gentiles comes in. But in the next verse, he does it so that he can provoke them to jealousy. And that's what's going on with Israel. And yet, at the end, when the fullness of the times of the Gentiles is fulfilled, you will have all Israel saved. Down in verses 25 and 26 where they are saved. But at the in the meantime, one other thing, and that is, in the meantime, today, Acts chapter 15, at the first church council, as we refer to it, when James speaks, he does say something that's very important. And it does say there that today God is taking out a people from the Gentiles for his name. And so God is predominantly dealing with Gentiles. A few Jews are saved, but mostly Gentiles are being saved today and become part of the church, become the church. And so this is the differences that we see looking back here into Jeremiah 31. Now in Jeremiah 31, again, I say that this is not doctrine we believe and practice. We don't get any practice out of what we're looking at, but we do see what God will do in his program and plan with respect to Israel. And so I'm going to begin looking at the appearance of the pre-incarnate Son of God to Jeremiah when he gives promise through Jeremiah that he will cut a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And this is just where we were left off when we started off looking at the new covenant. And the place I want to look at first is in Jeremiah chapter 30 and verse 1. And this leads us into what we were looking at in Jeremiah 31, beginning in verse 31. But this sets the backdrop. And what you see here in verse 1 is it says the word that was to Jeremiah from Jehovah, saying. And so he's to speak these things and to write these words in a book. And he does speak of days that will come. And he does speak right away that I'll bring again the captivity of my people Israel and Judah. And so he's going to bring them back, but in the meantime, the southern kingdom still hasn't been carried off into captivity, but they will be going soon. And so he speaks, though, of the future when they will be brought back together again. And so as you look at verse 1, though, when it says the word that was to Jeremiah, it doesn't say came, but it does speak of a being there. And so it would look at a presence, an appearance here. I would believe it would be an appearance because he speaks to Jeremiah. And so just to point that out, you can track it down through here. Jeremiah, he's not speaking from himself when he has the prophecy here. Verse 4, these are the things he's to write in the book, but he says these are the words that Jehovah spake. in concerning Israel and concerning Judah, verse 5, for thus saith Jehovah. Moving on down to verse 8, you have saith Jehovah. It shall come to pass in that day, saith Jehovah. Down in verse 10, saith Jehovah. We're not going to read all of the verses, but verse 11, 12, you can just track on down through the whole context here. Verse 17, saith Jehovah. And in verse 18, thus saith Jehovah. Again, he reiterates bringing the captivity back, and so on. And that, and then we move over to chapter 31. Well, 31, at the same time, saith Jehovah. And so Jehovah speaks again. Verse 2, saith Jehovah. And just down in verse 7, I'm just going to pick out all the way down to where we left off, though. Verse 15, thus saith Jehovah. Verse 18, the same thing. Verse 16, the same thing. You have it twice in 16. Verse 17, saith Jehovah. And end of verse 20 and 23, thus saith Jehovah. And now, as we come into the Jehovah is speaking, then he's the one speaking as we came into the new covenant. And you see that at the end of verse 28, it says, saith Jehovah, he's going to plant the nation Israel back in the land and so forth. But in verse 31, behold, the days come, saith Jehovah. And so this was a personal presence. Jehovah speaks. End of verse 32, saith Jehovah. And so Jehovah is the one speaking down through the context, but the word of Jehovah was, this is the word of Jehovah that was to Jeremiah. Now I pointed out when we looked at the word, I believe this is a reference to the appearance of the pre-incarnate Son of God to the prophet, and here it is to Jeremiah. And so he appeared and he speaks and he has a lot to say and he meets with him on different occasions and gives him further prophecies that he writes down here. But it is Jehovah who speaks down through the context. Now when you see the word of Jehovah, that reminds me of one other thing that we've emphasized looking around Christmas time. We looked at it, but that is where we find the word. Well, we find in John 1:1, we find reference to the Word who always existed. He was always in continuous existence whenever there was a beginning. And so he was the eternal Word who was not only face-to-face, always continuously in the past with the God, with the Father, but he as to quality and character was also himself continuously deity. He was God. And so he was, and it's that word, the eternal word, who came to be flesh in verse 14. But we do find that the word referred to as a person, and I believe here that when it says this, it's dealing with the word who speaks. He spoke to them, and he gives him some words, but he is the eternal word. He's the one who always appeared to man whenever there was an appearance, John 1:18. No man has seen deity, as nobody's seen God, nobody's seen deity at any time. But as the unique one-of-a-kind Son who's in the bosom of the Father, he's the one who's declared him. He's the one who's narrated him out before men, born him out for men to see. And so whenever they saw deity, it was going to be the pre-incarnate Son of God. And so that's where we are, and that's where we left off when we went looking at the new covenants. Now we're going to begin and kind of wrap up chapter 31, and we're going to move down through this this chapter as we come to the words that were spoken following the giving of the new covenant. And God is not through with Israel, and that's the thing that he makes very clear when we look at verses 35 through 40. God was not through with them, with the seed of Israel. That would be the seed of this, the nation Israel, the offspring of Jacob, from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In fulfillment of those promises, they will never cease to be a seed. And so in verse 35 it says, thus saith Jehovah, which giveth the sun for a light by day, and the ordinances of the moon and of the stars for a light by night. which divideth the sea when the waves thereof roar. Jehovah Sabaoth is his name. When it says Jehovah of hosts, the word hosts here is the word Sabaoth, but it looks at the one who is over the heavenly host, that is the heavenly armies. And so he's over heavenly armies, that is spirit beings, unfallen spirit beings, but those are his armies. And so he's the Jehovah Sabaoth, and that's his name. If those ordinances depart from before me, saith Jehovah, then the seed of Israel also shall cease from being a nation before me. And when it says forever, it just says all day, all the day. And so he uses the word yom for day here. It's not the term that we often find translated forever usually. But they would cease to be a nation. Well, he's not. Those are not going to happen. And that's the emphasis that he writes to through Jeremiah to these people. It's a guarantee that they will not cease to be a nation. Thus saith Jehovah, if heaven can be measured and the foundations of the earth searched out beneath, I will also cast off all the seed of Israel for all that they have done, saith Jehovah. But yet, as far as man is concerned, and back then, there was no way they could measure it, no way they could search it out beneath, within the earth. There were things. Now, scientists today, they see they can do some things, but they can measure to a point. But there's no way that man really has the capacity and the capability to understand and see what God does. And so we look at this, though, and so we see that God is not through with this nation, and he will not renege on his promises to them. But he will rebuild one day. Now, the city Jerusalem is going to be taken down, and so, but he will restore it someday. Now, Jerusalem has been built up and such, but this is a day when when God will have a hand in rebuilding the city of Jerusalem. And that's what he says in verses 38 and 40 then. Behold, the days come, saith Jehovah, that the city shall be built to Jehovah from the Tower of Hananiel unto the gate of the corner. And so he's dealing up in the northeast corner of the city, and the measuring line shall yet go forth over against it upon the hill of Gareb, and shall compass about the Goath. But it's going to cover the regions of the whole city, and the whole valley of the dead bodies and of the ashes, and all the fields unto the brooks of Kidron, unto the corner of the horse gate toward the east, shall be holy unto Jehovah. It shall not be plucked up nor thrown down any more, and this is into perpetuity. And so it's not going to be destroyed, and it's not going to be a perpetual kind of a thing, I think we could say there with the forever. But he's going to restore the city of Jerusalem in the future. Now with that, that follows after, this will be when he establishes, when he cuts this new covenant with Israel. The days will come then when all of this will take place. And so this is anticipating, again, the future for Israel. And they do have a future that's going to be a good future, a great future for them. Now, the next thing in the next chapter, down through verse 25, we come to the next appearance of the pre-incarnate Son of God to Jeremiah. And as we move into chapter 32, we find some interesting things. The timing of the appearance there, we see that he gives a time when the King Zedekiah, king of Judah, is going to be taken away into captivity. And that covers down through verse 5. And so now Zedekiah, he's still king. He's still in Jerusalem as Jeremiah writes these things. And we have a little discussion going on, and the discussion will cover between Jeremiah and Zedekiah. Now, Jeremiah, he has prophesied against Jerusalem and against Zedekiah. So what does Zedekiah do? Well, he puts him on hold. He imprisons him. Not in the dungeon, but he puts him on a hold, kind of. He imprisons him. So the place we find Jeremiah is in prison. And so we'll see that as we get into verse 2. But I wanted to begin in verse 1, and we'll just pick out verses 1 and 2, where you have the appearance of Jehovah, though, and the imprisonment of Jeremiah. And so it says once more, the word that was to Jeremiah from Jehovah in the 10th year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, which was the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar. And so we can track that back in history. For then the king of Babylon's army besieged Jerusalem, and Jeremiah the prophet was shut up in the court of prison. So he wasn't in the dungeon, but he was in the court of the prison. He wasn't in the worst part, but he was being taken a prisoner. And this was which was in the king of Judah's house. And so Zedekiah has locked him up and taken him prisoner. But you see, the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, he has surrounded the city now. And the city is going to go down just as Jeremiah, by the word of Jehovah, has prophesied. Now, picking up in verse 3, we come to the prophecy concerning Nebuchadnezzar taking the city. This is what Jeremiah has said. For Zedekiah, king of Judah, had shut him up, saying. And so this is what Zedekiah says as he locks Jeremiah up as he imprisons him. It says, wherefore, this is what Jeremiah said, wherefore dost thou prophesy and say, thus saith Jehovah, behold, I will give this city into the hand of the king of Babylon, and he shall take it. And so that's the first thing that Jeremiah said that kind of got under Zedekiah's skin, so he takes and imprisons him. But he goes on in the next verses, and you have a specific prophecy that Zedekiah himself is going to be carried off as a captive. And so Zedekiah continues repeating what Jeremiah the prophet has said. And Zedekiah, king of Judah, shall not escape out of the hand of the Chaldeans, but shall surely be delivered into the hand of the king of Babylon, and shall speak with him mouth to mouth, and his eyes shall behold his eyes. And so he's going to be standing face to face with Nebuchadnezzar, and he shall lead Zedekiah to Babylon. And there shall he be until I visit him. And this isn't just a friendly visit, until I punish him, saith Jehovah, though ye fight with the Chaldeans, ye shall not prosper. So this is Zedekiah. He heard the word, and he's able to repeat the prophecy back to Jeremiah. So Jeremiah responds then, and Jeremiah said, the word of Jehovah was unto me. And so here he says, he realizes this was the word of Jehovah that came to him as he has spoken these words. They're not just the words from Jeremiah. And he recognizes that it was the word of Jehovah who appeared to him as he responds to this to Zedekiah. And now in verse 7, and now you have an interesting thing. Jeremiah is told to go and buy a field. And so he had his cousin is coming, and his cousin will come and say, buy thee my field that is in Anathoth, the place where the priests live, for the right of redemption is thine to buy it. And so he has the right, he's the closest relative, and so this would go back to the kinsman redeemer. He has the right to buy the field. And so it's in the family, and so he comes and tells Jeremiah to buy it. We have the actual fulfillment of that taking place in verse 8. That when his cousin came to him in the court of the prison, and just as Jehovah had said to him, his cousin says, tells him to buy my field, I pray thee, that is in Anathoth, which is in the country of Benjamin, for the right of inheritance is thine, and the redemption is thine, buy it for yourself. Then I knew that this was the word from Jehovah. He knew that the one who spoke to him there was none other than Jehovah, because here the cousin comes just as was spoken to him in the court of the prison. And so Jeremiah is going to buy the field. In verses 9 through 12, you have a description of how he bought the field and what he paid for it and how he did it. But he went through all that he was supposed to do. In verse 11, he took the evidence. He took the documents of the purchase, both which was sealed according to the law and custom, and that which was open. And so he gave it to Barak. We'll see Barak again later on, but Barak the son of Neriah. And he did just as he was supposed to do by law, and he did it before all the Jews at the end of verse 12. We're in Jeremiah chapter 32. And so he, but to all the Jews that sat in the court of the prison, he did it before them all, and he did according to law in buying a property. Well, he bought this property, bought this field while he's in prison. Now we're going to see that this has something to do with the prophecy of the fact that Israel will be restored to the land in the future. They will be buying property, and so here Jeremiah, just on the verge of the time when the city is being overtaken, when the city is overtaken, at that point, he buys this field. But God is not through. They will buy property again. And so you have this prophecy given in 13 down through the beginning of verse 16. And so he has Barak take the evidence, it says, but he takes the documents here and he takes them and he's seals them up, and he's to put them in a earthen vessel. He's put them in a jug, and he's to put it away where it's going to be protected and last for a long time. And he goes on to explain in verse 15, "For thus saith Jehovah Sabaoth." Again, he addresses him as he says this is his name earlier, but he is the God of Israel. "Houses and fields and vineyards shall be possessed again in this land." And so that was to be evidence that they would be restored to the land. They would be able to buy properties again. "Now when I had delivered the evidence, that is, the documents of the purchase unto Barak the son of Neriah," now Jeremiah is going to pray to Jehovah. And so as we pick up at the end of verse 16, we find Jeremiah's prayer to Jehovah. And so as he addresses him, we're going to see his praise as he goes on down through here, and his remembrance of, he's going to acknowledge the fact that God is omnipotent, God is omniscient, is something that we will see. God is something, he is also faithful to his people. And so I'm just going to go ahead and read through these verses that deal with his prayer. We're going to read through Jeremiah's prayer with little comment on it. But he says, "Ah, Adonai Jehovah." And notice the spelling of Lord and God. But he really says, "Adonai Jehovah. Behold, thou hast made, you fabricated the heavens," should be the heavens, plural, "and the earth. By thy great power, two power words and stretched out arm. And there is nothing," it says, "too hard for thee." There's nothing that goes beyond you, beyond your capability. And so that's what he sees, he says. He sees the omnipotence of God, though, as he's bought this field and it's demonstrated what God will do. "Thou showest loving kindness unto thousands, and recompensest the perversity of the fathers into the bosom of their sons after them. The great, the mighty God, Jehovah Sabaoth is his name." So a second time he refers and says that his name is Jehovah Sabaoth, but he's also the great, the mighty God. And so he's the great one, the mighty God, but he is Jehovah Sabaoth over the heavenly armies. So again, we see his omnipotence recorded. Now he moves on to his omniscience when he says, "Great in counsel and mighty in work," but he is great in counsel, mighty in work, and mighty in doing things, "for thine eyes are open upon all the ways of the sons of Adam. forgive everyone according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings. And so God is able to do according to what he says, and he will do just that. But he is all wise, he's omniscient, he knows all, and he is all wise as to what he does. And so he will do right, and he is able to mete out to men what they have coming. And so that's as he continues in his prayer, though, we come down to the fact he goes back to something that the Jews always went back to, and that is the deliverance from Egypt. And so he goes on, which has set signs and wonders in the land of Egypt, even unto this day, and in Israel, and among other men, and has made thee a name as at this day, and has brought forth thy people Israel out of the land of Egypt with signs and with wonders, and with a strong hand, and with a stretched out arm, and with great terror. And we can go back and read about it in Exodus, but this was something the Jews always went back to and always remembered. God delivered them out of Egypt. He did it with many signs and wonders. So you have the seven plagues that took place, but God brought them forth. Then in verse 22, and has given them this land, which thou didst swear to their fathers, to give them a land flowing with milk and honey. And so you go back and you find that first promise of this was to Abraham in Genesis 15, verse 18 and following. And so God promised them land, and they were brought into the promised land. But God swore by an oath. And where did he swear by an oath? He swore by an oath to Abraham with the first Abrahamic covenant that he would give his seed land. And so he brought them into this land, though, that he had brought them out of Egypt and into the land that he had promised to their fathers. And then it goes on, and they came in and possessed it. And so God delivered them out from Egypt. He delivered them into the land, and they had the land. Now, the next part of verse 23 and into verse 24, he describes what they did when they got into the land. And this was a problem. This was the thing that got them into trouble down through their history. But they obeyed not thy voice, neither walked in thy law. They have done nothing of all that thou commandest them to do. Therefore, thou hast caused all this evil to come upon them. Behold, now, when it says the mounts, these would be weaponry. They are come unto the city to take it. And the city is given into the hand of the Chaldeans that fight against it because of the sword and of the famine and of the pestilence. And what thou hast spoken is come to pass, and behold, thou seest it. And so God has brought judgment upon Jerusalem. But throughout their history, they didn't obey. They didn't fulfill the law. They didn't order their lives by the law. They didn't do anything he told them to do. It just seemed to be a common thing in their history. They went through cycles, but God was bringing judgment upon them. And so the judgment has come as they are surrounded at this point of time by the Chaldeans, by Nebuchadnezzar's armies. And so now you have some instruction concerning he speaks of buying the field. And thou hast said unto me, O Adonijah Jehovah, I buy thee the field for money, and take witnesses, though the city is given unto the hand of the Chaldeans. So he's to buy this, though he's going to be, they're taken into captivity. He loses, if there's really no point in buying it, humanly speaking, because they're going to lose it momentarily when they're taken into captivity. But there's a reason why he is to buy it, and that does deal with God's promises to Israel concerning the land. And so again, we come to a second appearance now in this chapter, where the word of Jehovah was to Jeremiah and speaks to him again. And this picks up verse 27. Now we see his identification of himself, and he does question Jeremiah once more. He says, Behold, I am Jehovah, the Elohim of all flesh. And so when, from God's perspective, he is the God of all flesh. He's the one who's the creator of all things. But then the question, is there anything too hard for me? We saw that in verse 17. Is there anything that goes beyond what I can do? I think is the essence of what he says here. Is there anything? Well, the answer would be, of course not. There's nothing that God can't do. He is omnipotent, and Jeremiah spoke of that in his prayer, how God is omnipotent. There's nothing too hard for him, nothing that goes beyond his ability. Now, in verses 28 and 29, we come to the content of the message concerning the destruction of Jerusalem. And he says, therefore, thus saith Jehovah. And so Jehovah speaks as he appears to him again, continues speaking. Behold, I will give this city into the hand of the Chaldeans and unto the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, different spelling here, but of Babylon, and he shall take it. And the Chaldeans that fight against this city shall come and set fire in this city and burn it with the houses upon whose roofs they have offered incense unto Baal, and poured out drink offerings unto other Elohim, other gods, other Elohim, to provoke me to anger. And so God is going to destroy the city because they have openly gone out and committed spiritual adultery. They have gone out and they have been done idol worship up on the roofs of their houses. Throughout the land, we've seen that they were idolatrous. They had idol groves throughout the land. And so because of this, we see that this is why they're going to be destroyed and removed from the land. Now, verses 30 through 35 go on to describe why, and he goes through to describe it. Not a very pretty history of Israel, and the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, they are involved in this. For the sons of Israel and the sons of Judah, and when you have the word children, here's the word for sons, and both, whenever you see children, usually it's the word sons. And so, for the sons of Israel and the sons of Judah have only done evil before me from their youth. For the sons of Israel have only provoked me to anger with the work of their hands, saith Jehovah. For this city hath been to me as a provocation, something caused him anger. Of mine anger. So he's really, it's caused him to be very angry, and of my fury from the day that they built it, even unto this day, that I should remove it from before my eyes. And so right at the outset, you've always had in Jerusalem, they did their idol worship, and so they offered things to idols, and so God is going to deal with them because, in verse 32, because of all the evil of the sons of Israel and of the sons of Judah, which they have done to provoke me to anger, their kings. And notice who's involved. And we could go back and go through the kings of Israel and Judah, and we could go follow through, and we would see in their history. There were a few good kings, but there were many who were not, and they led the people astray. But it goes on, the people of Jerusalem, that is, and Judah, but their kings, their princes, their priests, even the religious leaders especially, and their prophets, and the men of Judah, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And they have turned unto me the back. And so they turned their neck to me, but they turned around and not the face, though I taught them. And so they knew what they should do. Jehovah taught them, rising up early and teaching them, yet they have not hearkened to receive instruction. They had all the instruction of the law, what they needed to do, but they didn't do it. But notice what they did instead in verse 34, as they defiled even the temple. But they set their abominations in the house, which is called by my name, to defile it. And so they even polluted the temple. And you see there how far their idolatry went in verse 35. And this was pretty bad when you stop and look at it. And they built the high places of Baal, which are in the valley of the son of Hinnom, to cause their sons and their daughters to pass through fire unto Moloch, which I commanded them not, neither came it into my mind that they should do this abomination to cause Judah to sin. And so they set things, they set their idol worships up, and they even ran their sons and their daughters through the fire. This was something they were forbidden to do, and yet they did it here in Jerusalem even. Now in verses 36 through 44, we have Jehovah's promise concerning the return of the people to the land to possess it. So now we come to a change here. You have a reference to the captivity first in verse 36, where Jehovah, where it says, "And now, therefore, thus saith Jehovah, the Elohim of Israel, concerning this city, whereof ye say, it shall be delivered into the hand of the king of Babylon by the sword, and by the famine, and by the pestilence." But now, as we come to verses 37 down through 41, we're going to see the restoration of the nation, and we're going to see the renewal of their relationship with Jehovah, just as God had promised them. And so as we come to verse 37, he says, "Behold, I will gather them out of all countries whither I have driven them in mine anger." Now, we could go back, and we won't, but we could go back to Deuteronomy. We see the curses in chapter 28, and back in that area, you see the curses. You also see blessings. Now, the curses are going to take place because of their disobedience, but the blessing will be ultimately that they will be brought back to the land, and they'll be brought back from wherever they've been carried off ultimately in the future. But that's what he says here again, that he will gather them out of all the countries where he has driven them. Notice he drove them, though he allowed the Gentiles to take them, and he did this in my fury and in great wrath, and I will bring them again unto this place, and I will cause them to dwell safely. So they will be returned to the land in safety. Notice now, this is something that was stated in the New Covenant. And this is something that will be established on the basis of the New Covenant, but it is something, this is not the New Covenant here, but it states this, what he will do as a result of it. "And they shall be to me for a people, and I will be to them for a God," reverses the order back in chapter 31, verse 23. But they will be his people again. Right now they're La'ami, not my people. But they will be again, and he will be their God. And then we find, again, something that will prepare them for the new covenant. Notice what he says in verse 39, "And I will give them one heart." And so they will have one heart. And we've noticed in Ezekiel chapters 36, 37, he's going to give them a new heart. He's going to give them a new human spirit. And so this is going to prepare them for the time when he will write his kingdom laws in their hearts, and he will do that. Their heart will be changed and ready to receive it when he writes his laws in their hearts, and they will also have one way, and so they're going to be changed. This is when Israel will be changed to where they will not be pursuing. They will have one straight way that they will stick to. And the thing we see here is that they may fear me. And when it says forever, it's again that all days. All the days they will fear me for the good of them and of their sons after them. And so they will have sons born when the kingdom is established and they're ultimately brought back into the land. But now, we come to, he has another covenant here. He says, "And I will cut," when it says make, it's that word cut, "an eternal covenant with them, that I will not turn away from them to do them good." And so he's not going to turn away from after them to do good to them. And this is something else, a reference to an eternal covenant. Now he's not going to turn away from them to do good to them. "But I will put my fear in their hearts, and that they shall not depart." They won't turn aside from me. Now, throughout their history, they did turn aside from Jehovah, and as a result, they're being carried off into captivity very soon here in Jeremiah. But as we saw back earlier in the chapter, but you have the promise now again of planting them in the land. "Yea, I will rejoice over them and cause them good, and I will plant them in this land." And he says, "Assuredly, he's going in truth with my whole heart and with my whole soul." Now, he uses what I would call here an anthropopathism. God is spirit. He's not soul, and he doesn't have soul, but he does use terms that man understand, and it's kind of like the anthropomorphisms where God doesn't have a hand or an arm either, but he does refer to soul here. We don't have time to spend time looking at that, but as we go on to verses 42 through 44, now you have the future buying up of fields, just as Jeremiah bought up his field. For thus saith Jehovah, like us, as I have caused this people, all this great evil upon this people, so I will cause upon them all the good that I have promised them. And so he will bring the good upon them, and the fields shall be bought in this land, a field shall be bought in this land, whereof ye say it is desolate, without man or beast, it is given into the hand of the Chaldeans. Well, it's going to be gone into the hand of the Chaldeans, but then as we come down to verse 44, men shall buy fields for money and subscribe deeds or documents and seal them and take witnesses in the land of Benjamin and in the places about Jerusalem, in the cities of Judah, and in the cities of the mountains, in the cities of the valleys, Shephelah, and in the cities of the south and the Gev, for I will cause their captivity to return, saith Jehovah. So God is going to bring them back, and Jeremiah, buying a parcel of land that was his in his family, when he bought that as they were going into captivity, well, they won't be buying now, but they will in the future, when God will bring the nation Israel back into the land of Israel. And so that we take it literally that they will be brought back in, and they will settle in peace and safety in the land, and their God will be their God again, and they will be his people again. But at this time, again, as we've been noting, not only will God cut a covenant with them when he brings them back into the land, but God is also dealing with something that we see as a parenthesis in the Old Testament. Before he brings them back into the land and fulfills his promises there, what will he do? What is he doing? Well, he's taking out a people from the Gentiles for his name. And he does have a different covenant with us, a covenant by Christ's blood, by which Christ is written in our hearts, and by which we can be transformed into that very image of the Lord from glory to glory, so that we can do that. So in the meantime, God is dealing with us, but yet God is not through with his people Israel. And the point is that we see here, by grace, God is now dealing with a people who didn't used to be his people. But now we are his people today, not as the Jews were or will be, but we are a unique people of God by grace. And so that's where we will stop. Father, we're thankful again for your word as we look at it. We're thankful that you are faithful and dependable, that you will one day come back and catch us away. Your son will come and catch us away to be with himself, be with you. And we do have a great future in store that we anticipate. It is our happy hope. And yet when we look at Israel, you're not through with them either. Even as they go through a time of terrible tribulation, yet when they come out of that, you will provide them, just as you promised them, a restoration to the land, bringing them out of captivity. And so again, we're just thankful for your grace today, and that you do have something better for us, but yet we're thankful also that, as we have seen in your scriptures in the Old Testament, your faithfulness to your promises, that in the future you will fulfill those promises with your people Israel as well. And so we do see you as dependable, and that we can today rely on you as we see you in that light. And so we're thankful again for your word this morning. Amen.